But I do think before they pivot to a ultra dovish monetary policy, we will need to see pain in the market, because the Fed is for the most part a reactionary agency. When the hole in the economy starts to open up, they go in and try to refill that hole by providing new either bank reserves or liquidity or whatever it is. But there's no point in there. If there's no hole for them to fill, then there's no need for them to do it.
Shut up and take the pain. Take the pain!
Hey everyone, and welcome back to Milkshakes Markets Madness. It's good to have you back. Last week, Brent and I took the week off. We had some traveling conflicts and some other things that came up. So we decided to not push the recording, and we're glad that we did, because it's going to be a fun week on this episode. A lot happened. Brent, before we get started, I think we should take a moment of silence for the death of the petrodollar.
Yes, it is very, very, very sad event in the history of the United States. You know, the 50-year anniversary came and went, and you know, since then the dollar has actually gone up, surprisingly, considering it has died. But it's been great to get the outpouring of love from around the world of all the people that love the dollar, and you know, wishing it was still around, but it's gone. So you know, that's the world we have to live in now.
Yes, well. We'll just have to pick up the pieces and move on. You know, speaking of other things that are probably now dead, and maybe we can pour one out for our homies in the Democratic Party. I think let's touch on the politics piece of this week really quick. Last night's debate, did you watch it? Do you have any comments? And what are your thoughts on what this means for the rest of the year?
I mean, it's just all so ridiculous. So I was at Moses's volleyball practice last night, and his practice started before the debate. So I'm sitting there in the stands, but I'm like, I'll pull it up on my phone and I'll just listen to it. And I missed the first intro. So I think I tuned in like 5 minutes late, and I listened to about 3 or 4 minutes of it. And it's just all so ridiculous. Like I was trying to force myself to listen and I just couldn't. So I put the phone away and just kind of watched practice. And then I got home and Mary was watching it. And this is where they're arguing about their golf swing, right? And it's just like, this is the state of things, right? Like Trump is you know, the same that just keeps rambling on and on. You know, Biden can't put a sentence together, and it all comes down to them arguing over who's the better golfer. And it's just sadness. I think sadness or madness, I don't know, whatever the right adjective is, but you know, this is the world we live in now.
Yeah, we've talked about on a previous episode how little tolerance we have for things that are cringy. That was very, very cringe for me. And I could barely take, you know, a handful of seconds of it. I tried even just watching some of the sound bites and clips that were being shared around Twitter and the rest of the internet.
You got to sit there and take, and apparently, you know, I did listen to a little bit of CNN after the debate. And, you know, even they were like, this is a disaster. And because there was really no covering for it on behalf of Biden. And so it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, whether he ends up staying in the race or they end up asking him to step down or what happens. I mean, I don't think anything is certain, but I think this has impact on markets because markets don't like uncertainty, right? And so if Biden does stick around until even, let's just say, September, and he has a couple more public appearances and they don't go well, you know, I think uncertainty starts to creep into people's mind. It would be better. I think markets would like it better if they knew for certain whether Biden was in or out, right? I think because like literally like CNN and a bunch of political pundits, you know, even on the Democratic side started saying, listen, Biden needs to seriously consider stepping aside. I think, whereas a couple of weeks ago they were saying, no way, no way, no way. Now they've actually brought that as a possibility into the arena. And, you know, again, I think markets would much prefer to know who the candidates are, because then they can start to at least game out whoever wins, what their policies would be. So, you know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but you know, all I know is a couple of weeks ago, everybody was saying, on the Democratic side, was saying Biden is the guy, he's totally fine. And now they're, you know, fully admitting that he's not.
It was super interesting about that overall is that, you know, Trump is usually anything around the Trump campaign is usually the chaotic part. And now we're in a situation where there's so much uncertainty on the other side, where that's supposed to be where the stability comes from. Now, neither one of us are, you know, hyper-focused on politics or political pundits ourselves or experts for that matter, but we do love a good conspiracy. And so speaking of this uncertainty, what's really interesting is, number one, if they're going to make any kind of change, we're running out of time because there's a number of states that have ballot cutoffs. So if you're going to put somebody else in there, you got to kind of do it now. And one of the things that I was kind of reading that was interesting is that, you know, there is a conspiracy or thought that this was one of the reasons they rushed this out of context or out of order debate early, was more or less to set Biden up to fail. So it was kind of a cruel way of making him fall on his face so that now they could have this conversation without it looking like it's something going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, you know, who knows what the real story is? You know, I certainly wouldn't put anything like that past him. I mean, at the end of the day, these people will do anything to get into power and to stay into power. So I just think the next 5 months are just going to be nuts. I mean, no matter what happens, it's just going to be crazy.
Well, let's talk about something else that no one expected. Is a little bit crazy, but certainly for you and I, much more on the positive side of things. And that's the welcome home of Julian Assange, who was finally released on a Department of Justice plea deal.
Yeah, I mean, that is honestly, like, I actually got a little bit emotional when he was walking off the plane. I can remember, so when he was first indicted, I think, was it 2011 or was it 2009?
The whole ordeal is about 12 to 14 years, so you can kind of work backwards.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact, but I remember I was in New York right after this happened, and I was at a buddy of mine's house or his apartment, and he was kind of having a cocktail party. And there was this guy who was kind of holding court, and I think his dad worked in the government or something, and he was holding court about how this guy was such a, you know, a traitor to the United States, and, you know, he had done this and that, and he should spend the rest of his life in jail. And everybody's like hanging on this guy's every word. And I remember I just kind of said, "You're out of your mind." And the guy was like, "What?" I was like, "Get real." I mean, this guy basically, you know, he's a journalist. He told the story. The story's true. And, you know, the government's mad about it. And so I have to say, the fact that he held out for as long as he did. Yeah. I mean, it's really incredible. I mean, I can remember being in high school reading this book, Profiles in Courage, right? And it was, I think it was written by John Kennedy, and he wrote about like five or six different people who had really kind of stood up for their beliefs and done the right thing despite all the odds against them. And I when I was watching him the other night come off the plane, I was thinking, man, this guy needs to be written up in the next Profiles in Courage. And here's the thing is, I think that government is completely wrong in this. I think they did the bad deeds and they didn't like it when it got let out. And so they're trying to punish him. And of course, they're saying it's treason, it's against the law. Well, you know, the law's wrong. But I'm also somebody who says, if the U.S. wasn't running the world, the alternative isn't great. So I really struggle with all of this, but I come down on the side of truth, right? And I come down on the side of doing what's right. And I'm not going to sit here and, you know, and say that there's not some downsides to what Assange did. But what I was very happy about is that in the write-up or the official documents in the court, they basically said no individuals were physically harmed by a result of anything that he exposed. And that's the government admitting that in a courtroom, in a U.S. government courtroom, right? And so all of the people, you know, who said that he was putting people in danger and people were being killed because of what he was doing, well, the government came out and said that that's actually not the case. So I know that there's strong feelings on both sides of this, but man, regardless of whether you think what he did was right or wrong, the fact that he kind of held out to his beliefs and spent all those years in solitary and in confinement and, you know, in asylum. And then he was in, you know, apparently this Belmarsh prison in UK is one of the toughest prisons in the UK. And it's just incredible.
Yeah. In Australia, they're very much a fan of using the word legend, and it's more kind of casual. You know, someone does something really fun or interesting or stands up in a given situation and does something cool. You tilt your hat and call him a legend. But in this particular case, he was on the cusp of becoming a martyr should he have passed away in prison. and now he's released and he's become a hero. And I certainly believe in not just in the eyes of Australians, but I think in the eyes of a lot of people in the world, considered a legend. And I think what was legendary is, despite all of that, you know, struggle he went through for a dozen years or more, his tweet was timeless and priceless. It was like, you know, it's been a while, but everything is okay. It wasn't like some sort of flex or cheap shot at what he went through. And I thought that was pretty powerful as well.
It's incredible. Incredible.
Well, before we jump into markets, and speaking of journalism, I think it's worth noting and refreshing everybody, because we're going to start pivoting and accelerating a little bit more on both the Masterclass and the Macro Alchemist. So anyone who hasn't yet sent us an email showing their interest for Brent's Dollar Milkshake and Global Macro Masterclass, please do that now. There will be an image on the screen that you can, you know, refer to later to get the email address to contact us and just say a quick note, hey, I'm interested. But that email is masterclass@milkshakespod.com. Now, Brent, is there anything else you want to add about that? Otherwise, please share a little bit more about the recent think piece that we released for the Macro Alchemist.
Well, I think I'll just reiterate again why I decided to do the Masterclass before I move on to the Macro Alchemist. So some people have already heard this, but if anybody's new and tuning in for the first time, essentially, you know, I've talked about this dollar milkshake theory for years now, and many people think that it's just the dollar going higher, or it's, you know, just the United States winning, but that's just an event and that's just part of it. But, you know, it's really a framework for how I think about the world and how I think about market structure and how the world actually works, or my conclusions about how the world actually works. And, you know, I'm very lucky that I get invited to conferences and I get invited to go on podcasts and give interviews. But when that happens, even under the best circumstances, it's, you know, maybe 30, 40 minutes, maybe an hour at the most. But the reality is, you know, I've been thinking about this stuff for hours a day for 15, 16, 20, you know, 19, 20 years. And there's a lot more that goes into it than a soundbite, a tweet, or, you know, a 30-minute presentation at a conference. And so I've had many people also ask me, you know, if there's a way that I can, if I've written a book on it, or if I've, you know, have something in writing, or if there's a white paper, or how they can implement it into their portfolio. And or some people have asked me to manage their money, you know, even though they're not the high net worth demographic that I typically work with. And so I figured this is probably the best way that I can kind of answer all of those different people in one simple way. And it's really just going to be a one-day intensive seminar on all the different factors that go into my framework. And you know, the reality is it'll probably be, you know, 5 to 7 hours worth of material. And that's going to be great, because it's going to be much more than I currently have been able to go into. But even that's not going to cover it all. I'm going to do my best to cover it in that time. And, you know, to the extent that people really want to dig in, it's going to be there. And if they don't, that's fine. But if they do, you know, the content will be there. And it'll be a way for me to kind of really dig in to why I see the world the way I do, why I think what's going to happen is going to happen, and kind of peel back, you know, the layers of the onion a little bit to kind of get into some of the things, rather than just, you know, seeing me, you know, send out a tweet that says this is going to happen. So that's going to happen. Call it early to mid August. Again, we're trying to negotiate around some travel times and logistics, but that'll be sometime in the next 6 to 8 weeks. I'm looking forward to doing it. It's going to be a lot of work, but I'm looking forward to doing it. And then, you know, what you also mentioned was the Macro Alchemist. And this is another way to kind of reach out to the people who have asked us for more content, or ask us if we have a newsletter, or ask us if we write research, or ask if we've written a book. And really what this is an outgrowth of a friend of mine who's, you know, been in the markets for a number of years, and he really loves to write, really loves to research. And he said, you know, and he and I will often talk and we'll debate and, you know, think about different topics. And so he just said, well, why don't we start putting this out? You know, we'll write up our thoughts on it and put it out. And if people want to read it, then that's great. And so that's the Macro Alchemist. So that what we're going to do is we're probably going to have, I don't know, 8 to 10 long think pieces a year. And then a number of other offerings or smaller based content that goes along with it. Our first episode or our first issue was released last week. It was basically about the interconnectedness of global real estate. We've really focused on China, but then how the rise of the real estate market in China led to a growth of real estate in the United States, Canada, and Australia, and how we think the ongoing problems in the Chinese real estate market will affect those other markets. Because again, we're no longer in a world where we have these local markets that are immune to what's going on in the rest of the world. And the fact that the world's going through a big divorce kind of heightens these interconnected markets, because they're going to get, as part of the divorce, they're going to get disconnected. And whether they get disconnected peacefully or violently, you know, that's kind of open to debate, but they are going to get disconnected to some extent. And we think that what worked really well on the way up may not work so well on the way down. So for anybody that's interested in that, again, you can go to macroalchemist.com. There's a sign up there. You send your information in, and then you'll get an email back with the report. And there's going to be more stuff of this to follow as well. This was just the introductory issue. And so we're looking forward to doing, you know, we've got a bunch of different things that we're going to be coming out with. And, you know, the masterclass and the Macro Alchemist are kind of top of the list.
Yeah, top of the list is a great way of putting it. There's a lot more to come. This is our 120th episode, I believe, of the Milkshakes podcast. We've been doing it now for just shy of 2 years. We're going to continue doing it. I think this is a great way to stay connected with everybody, but it's not enough in terms of taking specific topics, diving into them. It's not enough in terms of how we want to continue to grow the community. You know, some of the stuff that's on the Macro Alchemist side is going to be a bit more specific, granular, deep dive, somewhat more of the institutional research level. But we're also going to, you know, share other ideas in addition to the masterclass, that if you're more kind of on that retail side of things, or you just want the surface level, and the 1 week episode is just not enough, we have some great ideas for that as well. So stay tuned. We appreciate you listening so far in this week's episode and letting us give you an update on some of the things that we're creating. Let's get back to markets, Brett.
Yep.
Let's talk about the Mag 7. Let's talk about tech. It was a pretty interesting week for that sector.
Yeah, so I sent out a tweet yesterday, and I put two charts in there, both a daily chart and a weekly chart of the Mag 7. And I basically said, I think this is the last gasp of the Mag 7. And this wasn't just an arbitrary, you know, Brent's going to, you know, send out a tweet to get everybody riled up. You know, I do that from time to time, but that's not what this was. This was, I mean, I've actually been watching it. And again, there's a number of things that I look at before I put a trade on. And so what I've been watching, especially the Mag 7, everybody knows the Mag 7 has outperformed dramatically. It's you know, it's accounted for, you know, a huge, I think it's over 30% of the S&P's return is due to the Mag 7. You know, it gets more and more, the market has gotten more and more concentrated in a handful of stocks, while, you know, the Russell 2000 is basically flat for the year. I've been watching the Mag 7, and one of the things I look at is sentiment, and the sentiment on the Mag 7 stocks were as high as it's been. I look at relative strength. People have heard me talk about relative strength. The relative strength was as high as it's been at any point in the last 5 years. And we were coming into quarter end, you know, and not only that, but the semiconductors started to break down last week. So NVIDIA had a pullback last week, you know, Taiwan Semiconductor, Micron. You know, some of the high-flying semiconductor stocks already started to pull back, but the Mag 7s, which are, you know, like the Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, Tesla, some of the other non-semiconductor tech stocks were still at their highs this week, and we're coming into quarter end. So I thought this was probably an opportunity where they were going to pull back, and perhaps pull back hard, but pull back. So part of it, because again, everything was at its high. When you see a stock that has gone up several days in a row, it's, you know, it's got an RSI, you know, close to 90, and the sentiment's through the roof. Markets don't go in a straight line. And so that me saying, hey, we're going to pull back here, this, it's not some, you know, huge rocket science genius level insight. It's just looking at markets, understand how they work, and saying, this is, if we're going to have a pullback, this is a likely place. And part of the reason that I thought that was not only was everything really, really high, and not only had the semiconductors already broken down, but we're coming into quarter end. And people say, well, why does the quarter end matter? The quarter end matters because the way the structure of markets has changed dramatically. And what I mean by that is now passive kind of drives everything. You've heard us talk about this passive investing before. And, you know, when people get money in an account, or when people put money in an account, there's no thinking that goes on the side of the managers, whether this is a good time to invest or not. It's just automatically put to work. And as long as those flows keep coming in, that drives markets higher. But when someone says, hey, I need some cash, or hey, I need to sell, then all of a sudden there's no thinking. There's no time about thinking about timing. It's just sell. And if a lot of people start to sell at the same time, that can drive markets as well. And so we're coming into the quarter end, and Mag 7, and not only that, but bonds have not done well this year, right? So the point is that equities have grown up a lot more, have grown a lot more this year than bonds. We're getting into the quarter end. Big asset allocators are going to have to rebalance because now they're out of balance. Their equity allocation is overweight and their bond allocation is underweight. Now, perhaps you're sitting there thinking, well, why would anybody buy bonds? Well, it doesn't matter why they would. The fact is that they do. And pension funds and big asset allocators, they have an allocation to fixed income and they are going to meet that target. And so I thought that, you know, we would probably get a sell-off in the Mag 7 going into the quarter end. And so yesterday I bought some puts on some of the Mag 7 stocks and they were all down today. But I'm going to tell you a little insight here. And this will show people, I'm going to say this for a couple of reasons. I want to say that this job is not easy. It's actually very hard. I also want to say it's going to educate you a little bit. When people write research, or if they have a business where they're selling signals, hey, buy this here or buy this there, and then exit it at this price. Just because something traded at a price doesn't mean you could have gotten that price. It doesn't mean you could have bought at that price. It doesn't mean you could have sold all the shares you wanted to at that price. So remember this when people saying, I got in at this level, or I got in, or I got out at that level. Well, unless they're actually managing money and they can actually show you the trade ticket, you might want to question them on that. And so I'm going to give you a very good example. So some of the puts I bought were a couple weeks out. But a couple of them I bought were one day out. So everybody knows about these one day to expiration options, right? Now, this wasn't a big trade, but Microsoft was at the top of it. It was at its all-time high. RSI was really high. It was one of the leading Mag 7 stocks. And it was around 453, 454. And I thought, well, you know what? If we get this sell-off into the quarter end, it could easily pull back to 445, even 440. And so yesterday I bought puts when it was at 454, I bought puts at 450 that expired today. And I paid around 40 cents for them. And so all day today, I'm watching it and it's basically kind of flat to up a little bit. And then in the afternoon, it starts to pull back a little bit. And then around 3 o'clock, it starts to pull back a little bit more. And at 3:30, it went down to like 351, right? And I'm like, holy cow, maybe I'm going to get this. Well, it kind of bounced around, and at 3:58, literally with 2 minutes to go. And here's the thing is, you still have to like put the trade in, hit send. It has to go up. This, even if it takes a second, the point is you can't just say I'm out and you're automatically out. It takes a while to execute these trades. So with 2 minutes to go, I was like, well, I can't wait anymore. I want to sell these puts. So I sold them and I got like, I don't know, 37 cents for them. So I basically broke even, lost a tiny bit amount of money. If anybody goes and looks at their phone or their chart, they will see that Microsoft over the next minute and a half went down another percent and it closed at like 447. And so those puts that I paid 30 or 40 cents for ended up being worth $3. Now I basically got out even, but I could have made 10 times my money, right? So the reason I bring this up is this is a case where you can do the work, come up with a thesis. You can understand how markets work. You can put the trade on. You can be absolutely right. But if the execution doesn't happen in the right amount of time, you can still lose. So this is a trade where we lost a little bit, I mean, tiny amount of money on, but we had, but it just shows you like this job is not easy. Just because you have it all figured out doesn't mean you're going to be able to execute it at the way you think you are. So on the one hand, it's very frustrating, right? Because we could have made a lot of money on that trade and we didn't. I mean, we basically lost a very tiny amount, but the point is this, there's these people that, you know, they talk about investing and they write about investing, but it's totally different to actually do it. And again, I'm not telling this story in order to say, look at me. I'm telling this story to help kind of, again, peel the onion back, let people know that it's not quite as easy as say, hey, sell here, buy here. You know, there's timing involved. And if you're selling a lot of shares, if it's a big trade, it's harder to get it off, especially if you're doing something like options with like a minute to go. So anyway, that's just kind of a little bit of insight on how markets have changed. And again, that the reason that Microsoft did that, sorry, I should have said that the reason that Microsoft did that and all these Mag 7 stocks did this was, again, because of the quarterly rebalance. And these trades came in the last 2 minutes of these pension funds and these big asset allocators are selling their tech positions and they're probably buying their bond positions, or they're rotating out of tech. Maybe they're rotating into, I don't know, small caps or something. But this is and that happened in, you know, 30 seconds. And so markets can go from, you know, euphoric to desperate in a fraction of a second. And listen, this is the world we live in now. It's crazy.
So you're sharing that story. You kind of jump between 300 and 400. Microsoft's in the 400 range, but the other dollar amounts you had, right? It's, you know, more or less 454 down to 446, somewhere in that range.
Yeah.
One of the things I've been joking with Brent on a lot lately is he has a tendency to use the word again. I've kind of been editing it out.
How many times did I do it there? 20?
I've been editing it out, so I think I might just include a counter on this episode to make him pay for it, because I think it's the only way he's going to stop doing it is if it comes with some element of pain. So, you know, we appreciate that. It's good insight. I think the real point is being in the trenches is totally different. You know, when those shots are fired and you've got to decide if you're going to click the mouse and execute that trade, there's a whole basket of different types of psychology that, you know, comes into play. And you know, it's a perfect example. You had maybe a minute to go and you could have 10x, and instead, you broke even. But that's also why you need to think about this in longer terms and play the long game, because if you're betting everything on one trade, those types of things can happen.
Yep.
So let's talk about some of your favorite stuff, precious metals, and certainly some of your fans' favorite stuff, silver, gold, and digital gold, we'll call it in this conversation perhaps, had a bit of a sideways grind. And in the case of Bitcoin, it's definitely not holding up, at least to the narrative of what it should be doing in this type of economic environment.
Yeah, so, you know, I think on Monday morning, was it Monday or Tuesday? It was either Monday or Tuesday. Gold, you know, took a pretty hard sell off. Silver took a pretty hard sell off as well. I think gold went down to 2290. Silver went down to around 28 bucks or something like that. And, you know, then they bounced pretty decently. I mean, not huge, but they had a decent bounce here into the end of the week. I think gold's back at 23, 25, and silver's back above 29, I think. But Bitcoin, it's down like 10, 12% in the last week or so. At one point, it broke below 60K. I think it closed the week around 61. Is it around 61 right now or something like that?
It's at 60. It's about 6,100.
So it's
still pretty weak. It's about 12, down 12 on the month. And just around 6, or on the week, about 3%.
Well, I think what I'll say about this is, again, people that I just said it.
See, that's why I brought it up. Now you're thinking.
I need to get rid of that. Okay, so the reason I bring it up is because often you will hear, especially nowadays, you know, because inflation has been high the last couple of years, fiat currency is losing value. You have to get out of fiat. It's the death of fiat. Only an idiot stores their money in fiat. So you need to buy hard assets. And listen, that's a very valid thesis. It's very important to understand that fiat currency loses value. But it doesn't always go in a straight line. And anybody who listened to that advice 2 months ago and bought gold at $2,400 and silver at $31 or $32 or whatever it was, and copper at, you know, $4.25 or whatever it was, they're down pretty hard. And oil, I think oil has kind of come back up. But the point is it's not a given. You know, getting out of fiat and going into hard assets, it's not a foolproof strategy. If you have a very long time horizon, that certainly helps, but it's not a foolproof strategy. So I think it's important to have these things in your asset allocation. It's important to have some of your assets allocated for longer term appreciation, which typically happens as fiat currency loses value over time. But don't go all in on anything and don't expect it to pay off in, you know, 1 or 2 months. For me, Bitcoin, it's very similar to the Mag 7. And I think Bitcoin is just a pure play on global liquidity. I don't think it's money. I don't think it's the new gold. I don't think it's, you know, the greatest asset that's ever been. Now, it's a great speculative asset. And listen, people that have made money on it, I clap my hand to them. It's not easy to speculate on anything and do really well. And the fact that they speculated on Bitcoin and became fabulously wealthy, I tip my hat to them. But I do think it's largely a result of global liquidity, and global liquidity is pretty good right now. And as a result, you know, Bitcoin has been high, but, you know, over the last couple of weeks, liquidity seems to be coming out a little bit or falling a little bit. And that's why you've seen equity weakness start to happen. That's why some of these hard assets are starting to pull back. And I think Bitcoin is right in there with it.
So in the event that we do have a recession, let's go pull on the thread that it's inevitable. We don't know when. Let's say it's sometime in the near future. Maybe it's in the next 24 months. You look at things like yield curve inversion, we're probably potentially closer, but maybe we're in some kind of new paradigm because of the things that went on during the 2020s after the 2020 QE injection. So if we do see our economy roll into an official recession, this is probably going to be something that affects global markets, and global markets may very well be in recession before the US, which is something you talk about frequently. What do you think is going to be the impact on liquidity? Do you think the Fed is going to be doing some of the things it has been doing all along, you know, this backdoor liquidity, either through, you know, the repo and other types of stuff like that? And the other aspect to the question I have here is, do you think despite maybe a reduction in liquidity, markets will stay strong simply because of the front running and trading on the expectations that new liquidity will be coming right around the corner?
Well, I think what you just said, the last sentence of what you just said is what we've had for the last couple of months. I think the reason markets have stayed high is the expectation of future liquidity or future additional liquidity coming from the Fed. And listen, the Fed has very clearly signaled that they want to cut rates. Now, why they want to cut rates, I think that's open to debate, but they couldn't have hinted at it anymore. Right? Powell could not have been any more clear that they're expecting to cut rates and that the next move will be a cut rather than a hike. That being, and as a result, I think that's why markets have stayed high. That being said, I don't think that the market, when I say market, if equities pull back 5% and gold goes down at $100 and, you know, inflation drops a little bit, I don't think that they're going to be in a huge hurry to do multiple cuts. I think they might cut once just so they can say that they did it, right? But I don't think that we're going to have a situation where the markets pull back a little bit, the Fed pivots and pivots hard and goes back to QE immediately. And then, you know, we're back to equities going up 25% a year and, you know, gold's at 3,000. Now, can I rule this out? No, I can't rule it out, but I don't think that's likely, because if they were to pivot that hard, I think they would do it for two reasons. One is they would be forced to do it because markets were cratering. And if markets are cratering, then they're protecting against deflation, right? In other words, they would be reacting to markets pulling back really hard. And they're not going to go to QE next month or 2 months from now with markets at their all-time high, inflation on its way down, and you know, unemployment at its all-time low. If they were to go to QE ahead of the election, I mean, that would just be, you know, they would have so many credibility problems if they did that. So, but if the market starts to melt down and, you know, stocks pull back 25% and copper's at $2 and, you know, gas is at, you know, oil's at $35 and we have a deflationary scare, then yeah, they're going to come in and they're going to do whatever they need to do. But I do think before they pivot to a ultra dovish monetary policy, we will need to see pain in the market, because the Fed is for the most part a reactionary agency. They when the hole in the economy starts to open up, they go in and try to refill that hole by providing new either bank reserves or liquidity or whatever it is. But there's no point in, if there's no hole for them to fill, then there's no need for them to do it. So it's a very long way of saying, I think what you said there is really what we've seen. And I think we're kind of coming to the end of that. And so I think the second half of the year is going to be much more difficult than the first half of the year. I don't expect, you know, equity markets to be up 20 or 30% in the second half and we have another year like we had last year. Can I rule it out? No, I can't rule it out, but that's not my expectation.
Well, looking at beyond the chaos of the election, let's say Trump is elected. Maybe we could take this morning's price action as an example of how markets might react to that. It was a little iffy for bonds. Equities didn't really seem to mind. I had asked you this before, and it's probably worth bringing up again. Do you think markets are going to give us another 2017 where, you know, everyone believed that Trump's policies would be pro-business and inflationary? Bonds did not like that. Equities took off running because they do like that. Do you think we're headed into, if Trump is elected, a version 2.0 of that market response?
I think it's possible. Yeah, I think it's it. And again, it kind of goes back to just my overall framework. Like, if I expect there to be a lot of volatility between now and, let's call it, the inauguration of whoever the next president is. And at some point along the way, they're probably going to have to go back to easy monetary policy. Or I shouldn't say that. It would not surprise me if they have to go back to easy monetary policy. And if they do that, you know, I think the whole world is going to, again, flock to the U.S. And if they don't do that, I think the world is, the U.S. is still going to be seen as the cleanest dirty shirt and the, you know, relative, you know, safest port in the storm. And so I think capital flows will continue to come to the United States. Now, whether they come at the same rate or as they have, I don't know. And are they coming as a result of new money being created by central banks around the world? Or is it coming just as a result of the market liquidities are there? You know, I don't know that. But I do, I think I put out a chart a week or so ago of kind of what my base case is. And, you know, I'm always happy to give my base case because I don't really care if my base case ends up being wrong. If my base case ends up being wrong, then I'll change and, you know, I'll adjust to it. But my base case is that we're probably due for a pullback here. Maybe it only pulls back a couple percent, 2 or 3% over the next week or so. And then I think we'll probably rally into the Fed meeting at the end of July, beginning of August. And then I don't think they will cut. And so I think that will probably bring some more volatility into September. And I think they'll cut in September. And so I think we'll probably have some kind of down market into September. And then they'll cut and there'll be a couple weeks of euphoria because they cut. And then people will wake up and realize that nothing's really changed. One cut doesn't really do anything. The election's coming up. There's a lot of uncertainty. And then I kind of think the last couple months are probably to the downside and a little bit volatile. But I do think, but you know, the powers that be will do everything they can to keep the markets running smooth, you know, into the election. But you know, just because they want things to run smooth doesn't mean that they will. So, you know, that's kind of my base case. My base case is we're going to have a lot more volatility over the next 6 months than we had the last 6 months. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see. It's a crazy world.
Yeah, the safest port in the storm has certainly been on display when you compare it to the Japanese yen. Before you share your thoughts on some of the price action in the yen, let's talk about next week, and then we can wrap up with sure. Forex markets. We've got a short week because of the July 4th holiday, but interestingly enough, they are going to release the non-farm payroll employment data on the Friday after July 4th. We also have a Fed Powell speech and the Fed minutes. So some of the things that you are kind of speculating on or putting your thoughts on here, we'll potentially get some more insight on next week. So you have thoughts about next week's calendar, and then share your thoughts with us about what's going on in the end.
Well, yeah, there's a lot coming. It's funny because next week, if I would have just looked at it on the calendar, I would have said that's probably going to be a quiet week. You know, it's the end of the quarter, going into 4th of July, people will be out. But, you know, we've got non-farm payroll. And I actually thought that they would kick non-farm payrolls to the following Friday. But, you know, we looked a little bit ago and they are still planning to release it next Friday. Fed minutes is often something that can move markets. That comes out on Wednesday, but the Fed minutes come out at 2 o'clock, but the market's closing early on Wednesday due to the 4th of July holiday. So the market will already be closed when those come out. I'm not sure what time Powell's speech is. I'm guessing that it will be in the morning. So maybe he will have some comments that move the markets. You know, in general, every time he spoke for the last, you know, several times, the markets have liked what he has had to say. So, you know, whether that provides some upside or maybe now they'll be expecting some upside. And if he doesn't deliver it, you know, it's going to be a very thin market on Wednesday when he's speaking, because, you know, people are going to be out. So, you know, it could really go either. Okay. So this is the prediction. Wednesday will be a huge move one way or the other. I'll just say that. And I, you know, which way it goes, I don't know, but it will be a big move.
All right. Always good to get a Brent hot take. Give us your hot take on the yen.
The yen. The interesting thing about the yen is that we have talked about it so many times on this episode or on this show. But the reason we talk about it is because it is the poster child for everything that everybody thinks will eventually happen to the dollar. And that's why it's interesting to talk about it. And it's a really important thing. The yen is responsible for a lot of global liquidity. And what I mean by that is the fact that the yen has been a weak currency with low interest rates has led to a number of people around the world doing the yen carry trade, where you borrow in yen because it doesn't cost you anything because interest rates are zero and it continues to fall in value. So you end up paying back that loan that you've taken with depreciated currency. So it's a very attractive currency to borrow in. And then you take those funds that you borrowed and you go buy stocks or real estate or fixed income or whatever. So you lever up using the yen and then you go buy these assets. And here's the problem is that if the yen continues to fall, the yen is back to where it was in 1986. It's amazing, right? And I think it's going a lot lower now. But again, I've said this many times, markets don't go in a straight line. And so it won't shock me at all if this is the level at which the Bank of Japan came out a few months ago and intervened. They've been talking about doing it again. I would expect them sometime in the next week to intervene again and try to get it weak. Because if it goes past this level, it's just like clear daylight all the way to like 200. There's no technical resistance. And if that happens, there's good news and bad news from that. The good news is if the yen continues to weaken, then the yen carry trade is in full effect. And the people that have liquidity from that are liquid and they're using those funds to deploy elsewhere. The problem is the weaker the yen gets, the more pressure it puts on the Chinese yuan. And China is having all kinds of problems in their markets, especially the real estate market. We wrote about it extensively in our Macro Alchemist that we talked about. One of the ways that China might have to face this economic deflation that they're feeling in their real estate market is to depreciate the yuan. Because as the yen gets weaker, China competes with Japan. If the Japanese currency is weaker, then Japanese goods are cheaper than Chinese goods. And it just puts pressure on the Chinese economy that is already feeling deflationary pressure. So one of the ways that China might seek relief is to devalue the yuan. The problem is if China devalues the yuan, that sends a deflationary wave to the rest of the world. And that would be, you know, again, all kinds of problems if that were to happen. And so, but the flip side is what happens if Japan actually raises rates? Okay, well, that's a problem too, because if they raise rates in order to strengthen the yen, then that scares some of the yen carry trades, those people that have levered up. They, you know, sell the assets that they've bought with the yen proceeds that they've borrowed in. That puts downward pressure on those assets. And so basically the yen getting stronger is a rug pull on global liquidity. So we're kind of at this level. And then remember, the dollar's at like 105, 106. And the dollar's really gone sideways for 2 years now. You know, it ran up to like 113, 114 in the early fall of 2020. And it pulled back to 106 by the end of the year. And that's basically where it is. So it's been, you know, it's been there for 18 months. So it's basically gone sideways for 18 months to 2 years at this point. And if it breaks out of that range to the upside at the same time that the yen is either is weakening, or if the dollar were to break out at the same time that the yen rallies, the dollar and the yen rallying together versus the yuan falling in value, that is the mother of all deflationary nightmares. And that would cause all kinds of problems. So the point is we're kind of at these levels where a lot of really crazy things will happen. Now, will they happen? I don't know. But I think we're in an environment where the VIX is at its all-time low. We're at these very critical levels in currency land. I think currencies are the most underrated or underappreciated factor in global finance that many investors don't even have any clue about. And so if things start to go crazy in the currency market, we could very quickly have a lot of volatility in the other markets.
Well, let's keep an eye on both the yuan and the Japanese yen over the coming weeks, mainly because a big part of this conversation and some of the assets that we highlighted, the Mag 7 specifically, Bitcoins and other, are very liquidity driven. I think most of the conversations in macro have continued to evolve around what liquidity is doing and where we think liquidity will go. And as you mentioned, as long as the yen remains weak, that liquidity fuel should be at least continuing to flow around and get recycled. Now, a yen, you know, blowing out from 160 to 200 in short order would create a lot other types of chaos in other parts of the market, other parts of the currency market. So we'll keep an eye on all those. We'll keep sharing our thoughts on those in coming episodes. And maybe there'll even be a deep dive or think piece at the Macro Alchemist on some of these things. Brent, we appreciate you joining us. Enjoy your weekend. To everyone else, thank you so much for joining us. You can join Brent on Twitter using his handle, SantiagoAUFund. You can find me there using John Kutzmita. And you can find the show both on Twitter and on YouTube using the handle MilkshakesPod. If you've been listening this long and forgot about the masterclass email, that's masterclass@milkshakespod. Please send us an email showing your interest. This will be the last time we bring it up here and the last time you have an opportunity to send us an email with your interest. After this, we're going to announce it more broadly and the discount will no longer be applicable. So we appreciate everybody. Talk to you guys real soon. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.